Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today on our program, the quest to reclaim Iraq's lost art treasures, plus a live performance from the Brooklyn-based singer and songwriter Luke Temple. But to begin, in the mid-1960s, James Osterberg Jr. was just a kid from Ypsilanti, Michigan. Jim, as he was known, was vice president of the student council, a standout student, and a delegate to the Model UN. So how did that boy become this man? I'm a sleepwalking cheater with a hat full of napalm. I'm a runaway son of the nuclear A-bomb. Iggy Pop. He made and broke the mold for gonzo rock front men everywhere. With this band, The Stooges, he was also the catalyst for the punk bands who would turn rock music on its ear starting in the mid-70s. Since that, Iggy's had his ups and downs, but he's emerged from them all, apparently indestructible. Joining us today is Paul Trinka, former editor of Mojo magazine and author of the new biography, Iggy Pop, Open Up and Bleed. Paul, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, John. It's great to be here.
So Iggy is about to turn 60. He is touring with the surviving Stooges, Scott and Ron Ashton, in support of a new record. The New York Times called his concert here in New York, Chaos at the Line Where Performer and Audience Blur. Why is there still such an enthusiastic audience for the almost 60-year-old Iggy Pop?
Well, because the music he created is still vital, it's still cutting edge, and, you know, there's still a damn great live band. How he does it is kind of impossible to say, but he still really is the ultimate rock frontman.
Well, now, your book opens with the ultimate rock frontman fronting this band, the Stooges, in a concert that it would be charitable to call it a disaster. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Michigan Palace, two concerts, in fact, in 1974 in Detroit. Why is that show so important, such a pivotal moment in telling the story of Iggy Pop?
Because it was really the ultimate rock and roll disaster, but one that ultimately was seen as a triumph. The Stooges had had this disastrous last tour where they'd been assailed by everything conceivable. The singer had fallen unconscious countless times, had been thrown on stage, had fallen off stage, was becoming something of a laughing stock, would appear every night in the most ludicrous costumes. It might be a ballet dancer's leotard or a little shawl wrapped around his waist like a skirt. And the band was still playing this very intense music like we've heard it earlier, but were kind of becoming a comedy act. And meanwhile, all their stamina was just running out. These were guys with incredible self-belief who thought they were going to change the world. And of course, they didn't. The world just laughed in their faces. So the Michigan Palace shows, which were taped, then became this almost like a religious relic. They were taken back by a writer called Nick Kent to Paris, and the tapes were released, and it had a huge influence on the burgeoning English punk movement, and not all to the good either, because that's what made throwing bottles at bands or spitting at them or just violence or the general negativity part of the whole English punk movement. But really, you know, if rock and roll is about living on the edge, that's about as on the edge as it gets.
So in fact, they did end up changing a little piece of the world, at least.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Paul Trinka, who's the author of the new biography of Iggy Pop. He's joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. You write about his childhood, his adolescence, his early band, the Iguanas, from whence the name Iggy comes. This was a smart kid, an overachieving kid with good parents who, you know, were educated. How did he become Iggy Pop?
Well, how did he go to the bad? Well, I guess it started out, there were two early influences. One was, he was so ambitious, I think, in terms of his political career, while he did very well, he came second. He ran at Boys State, which is where Bill Clinton came to fame, but Jim came second. I think he wanted to come first. So that actually being a singer, you know, that was a role where nobody else could rival him. But all those early experiments of the Stooges, who were a very kind of avant-garde arty band, who used to use vacuum cleaners as part of their performances or wearing blenders, they were just mocked and reviled by the Detroit audiences, who just ignored them or would walk away. So he decided to react to that by getting in their faces. And the Iggy Pop persona almost became like this old alter ego that was impervious to all the mockery and the abuse. And so Iggy earlier on was a very good vehicle for Jim Osterberg to express himself. But later on, as in so many kind of cheesy science fiction movies, the alter ego took on a life of its own.
All right, well, let's go to the year 1969 and the song 1969 from the 22-year-old Jim Osterberg, by then the alter ego of Iggy Pop, firmly established.
It's 1969, okay. Walk across the USA. It's another year for me and you. Another year with nothing to do. It's another year for me and you. Another year with nothing to do. Now last year I was 21. I didn't have a lot of fun. And now I'm gonna be 22.
The song is 1969 from Iggy Pop, Iggy and the Stooges, and boy, you know, Paul, that is about as simple as music gets. I mean, we talk about three-chord crash, but there are only two chords in this song.
Exactly. any other band would have resolved that chord or gone to a third chord. But it makes sense musically because that's the music of kind of claustrophobia, of being trapped in Ann Arbor with nothing happening and nothing to do. And that's what the music is like. You don't get away from those relentless chords right until the end, until the freak out at the end.
So throughout your book, you refer to Iggy and you refer to Jim, almost as if they're two different people. Is that what it comes down to? And did one sort of overtake the other at times?
The short answer is yes. And of course, to some extent, that's a, you know, one is using it as a writer's shorthand. But then when you speak to people who know him, you know, people like Esther Friedman, his girlfriend, who met him in Berlin and knew him from 1976 to 83, she'd go, well, Jim, he was this sweet guy who'd buy me presents. You know, he'd do little skits to cheer me up. And then Iggy was just this guy who, after a gig, would just walk into the dressing room, pick out a number of group and say, you, and you, right in front of her. And she'd go, but that wasn't Jim, it was Iggy. Mm. And of course, some of that is an excuse for the guy, but definitely when you meet him, there are two different people. And it's like any great part that any actor inhabits, you know, they draw from within themselves and it gives them a license to be somebody different. And ultimately, I guess the view of his psychiatrist is the valid one, where he just said, well, Jim Osterberg had these personae and he wasn't in control of them. So it got to the point where he just didn't know who he was anymore.
And so drug abuse, you know, sort of rears its ugly head early in the story of Iggy Pop and pretty much, you know, continuously until relatively recently, right?
Yes, I mean, really, just after that first Stooges album. Well, in fact, when he was doing the Stooges album, he was dropping acid more or less every day. When they made the second album, he dropped acid every single day with a huge toll on his psyche. And then the CIA helped the supply of marijuana dry up in Michigan, so everybody turned to heroin instead. And then, you know, from that point on, everything going he would take. And it wasn't really until 1985 or 86 when he really made a huge effort to become clean and did it just by kind of force of will.
Mm. Now, from 1967 to 74, Iggy Pop and the Stooges recorded three records, The Stooges, Funhouse, and Raw Power, which at the time were not considered, I mean, they certainly were not commercially successful, and they weren't playing the big arenas. Who were they playing to? Who was in the audience?
Well, in the around Detroit in the area, they would have an audience who were kind of like local misfits. So they'd either be the very cool kids or they would be just the people who Iggy would probably characterize as losers with bad complexions who just identified with the Stooges, who were a kind of losers band. Yet at the same time, they had this very cool Andy Warhol influenced set from New York who loved them, and the same kind of, and then later on in LA, actually all the kids who later on formed the LA punk scene were huge fans, would go and see them every night at the Whiskey, but this was maybe a couple of dozen kids, you know, all of whom later went on and formed bands.
Right.
And
then, well, that's the old thing about, you know, the punk rock scene. It's like, you know, 10 kids in the audience and 5 years later, they all form their own groups.
Exactly. And that's what happened.
Well, the Stooges recorded this song, Down on the Street, on their album Funhouse. Down on the Street, Iggy Pop and the Stooges from the album Funhouse. We're speaking with Paul Trinka, who is the author of the new biography, Iggy Pop, Open Up and Bleed. And Paul, this is an instructive song for a couple of reasons. I mean, Iggy is more snarling his lyrics than actually singing them. But there's also a lot of whooping and hollering, especially at the beginning of the song, all of which kind of hints at his onstage antics. I mean, you talked before about, you know, the band would be assailed with things, you know, people throwing stuff. Iggy invited that sort of behavior and still does to this day.
Oh, well, absolutely. And that really, that one song and all of the Funhouse album, it was recorded like a live album. So Iggy was there singing with a handheld microphone, just conducting the band, just using his voice as another instrument, this kind of these abstract noises, you know, and they just drive the whole thing on in a very kind of abstract way, but there's still this kind of visceral energy and a kind of swagger about the sound. And by that time, you know, the band had become very confident. They thought they were about to break. This was very close to the famous moment at Cincinnati when Iggy walked out into the crowd and they just lifted him up and mm-hmm. he walked over them. And this would happen night after night, or he'd disappear, you know, into the crowd.
Yeah.
And people would just think, you know, he was being interfered with sexually. And he was like, you know, a kind of a young god. And they, you know, right at that time, everybody around the band really thought they were going to break.
Well,
but they didn't.
But they didn't. Now, your book is called Iggy Pop, Open Up and Bleed, and obviously Iggy Pop is character A, but there is a very strong B character in this book, and that is David Bowie, who is credited with having sort of resuscitated Iggy Pop's career as a soloist in the mid-70s. What was the connection there?
Well, David had first bumped into Iggy in New York and had signed Iggy and the Stooges to the Mainline Operation, which was his big kind of rock and roll circus. Lou Reed was signed up at the same evening. And in those early days, it's probably true that Iggy had been just accumulated as a kind of trophy to make Bowie look a bit more credible. But then, and then later on, he was dropped, you know, as a trophy just outlived his usefulness, not via Bowie's request, but via his manager who'd had enough of him. But then later on, Bowie hit his own troubles, and Bowie, you know, had encountered his own psychological traumas. But one person who was in an even worse position than him was Iggy Pop, who was basically sleeping rough in Los Angeles. And Bowie seemed to find a kind of solace and meaning in rescuing Iggy and helping him, and actually being a very selfless person, in huge contrast to probably who he was before. And so together they made The Idiot and Lust for Life. And The Idiot was really some of Bowie's finest music, all of which he just gave to Iggy and over a stint of incredible creativity. So whilst there's all this negativity of the story, you know, you get this little drama of two people wandering around in Paris and Munich and Berlin by themselves, just
you
making this
them
music.
You describe them as two damaged souls who kind of helped, in a sense, to heal each other.
Exactly.
With songs like Sister Midnight, which was the first song that David Bowie brought to Iggy Pop. We're speaking with Paul Trinka, the former editor of Mojo magazine and author of the new biography, Iggy Pop, Open Up and Bleed.
Breaker.
Sister Midnight is from the album The Idiot, the first of two records that Iggy Pop did with David Bowie, largely in Berlin, where Bowie was ensconced for some of his own most groundbreaking music in the mid-70s. Paul Trinko, the combination of, the two guys, both in their late 20s, both of them kind of mutual admirers of each other's, and both sensing something in the other that they didn't have, seems like it would have been a recipe for a very long and fruitful creative relationship. Was it?
Well, it did go on for a long time, but Bowie obviously was a very busy guy. He had his own stadia to tour. So they made two albums together. We were very close over Bowie's whole Berlin period. Bowie finally left Berlin at the beginning of 78, and they'd lived together in Schöneberg on the Hauptstrasse.
And, near the wall.
Well, they were a little bit away from the wall, but most of the material was actually recorded at Hansa 3 Studios overlooking the wall, where there were DDR guards literally overlooking them with submachine guns.
Well, what's their relationship like now? I had read that Iggy refused to talk to you about Bowie.
He is very dry about Bowie. He really refuses to, he doesn't speak about the guy with any warmth at all. And I think there's a kind of resentment there because both guys themselves have got this massive ego, but probably of the two, it's Iggy who has the bigger ego. And I think over the years, he's just had enough of being questioned about Bowie, of actually it being suggested that he has a debt to him. And I think that's something that saddens Bowie. Bowie was the one person who wouldn't speak to me, although he comes, I think, very well out of the book. But there was one, he did kind of break open and sort of reveal himself in the late 90s when he just said he was very upset because Iggy didn't call, didn't really speak to him. And he thinks it was just because over all those years, he's had enough of people going on about, but David did this for you and David did that. So yet, Iggy does sort of, he uses the right words in terms of thanking Bowie, but there's not really any warmth there. But that's psychologically understandable when you think that he does owe the guy a lot, and sometimes we find it difficult to really acknowledge our debts when they are profound ones.
Well, Iggy Pop has rebounded from some pretty low times at various points during his career, and he finally scored a hit in 1986 with Real Wild Child, and again, whether he likes to have this said or not, it was with David Bowie's help. This is from the 1986 record Blah Blah Blah.
Well, I'm just out of school.
Now, Real Wild Child was a commercial success for Iggy Pop, but more was still to come in the 1980s, or actually 1990, when he teamed up with Kate Pearson of the B-52s on this hit song, Candy. From the 1990 album Brick by Brick, Iggy Pop with Kate Pearson of the B-52s and the hit song Candy. We're talking with Paul Trinka, who is the author of the new biography, Iggy Pop, Open Up and Bleed. And Paul, in reading through your biography, I mean, there are lots of things that even as a longtime fan of Bowie and Iggy Pop, I didn't know about their relationship together. But there's also this kind of disturbing undercurrent of Iggy and his attraction for 14 and 15-year-old girls. I mean, these days, that kind of thing gets you arrested. How did he get away with that as recently as the 1980s?
Well, in the early days, when you speak to people from the time, it was something that wasn't seen as dark, and it wasn't seen as exploitative. And when you speak to the girls, and they were girls, 13 or 14 at the time, you know, there was an innocence about some of those early experiences, but that soon turned very dark. And you know, there was certainly a lot of heroin going around in the scene in 1974. And then by the time in the 80s, this guy's now in his 30s, and he's still manipulating young girls. Not very often, but there were a couple of cases, and I did find one woman who knew him, and she was 14 or 15. And there was, you know, from her point of view, I think she called the guy essentially a kind of psychic vampire. He wanted to suck off her energy. And also, it's a classic thing of an older guy just wanting to be adored, to find younger girls who will just not really say, well, you're messed up, you know, get yourself sorted.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, at that point, it gets very dark and very abusive. Although it's got to be said, the guy himself was ill at the time. He was heading for another nervous breakdown, but definitely, in you know, there's a lot of heroism in the story, and there's a lot of great music, but there's a lot of exploitation and betrayal and darkness there as well.
Now, there is in your book a series of pictures. The last of them is Jack White holding a shirtless Iggy Pop in his arms, almost like, you know, the famous statue, the Pietà. Why is there yet another generation of musicians at a time when rockers have really cleaned up their image and we don't have that sense of danger on stage so much? Why is there another generation of rockers worshipping at the altar of Iggy Pop?
Because even behind all that excess, there's a kind of purity to the music. It's just so simple. It just speaks to each generation of kids who come along. It's not like the kind of baroque excesses of the late 60s, which were very stylized. It's like something that is so basic and so primal that it truly is timeless. It's like they've excised a certain amount of the kind of, you know, of the style that dates, and just cut everything down to its essentials. And what are people but the White Stripes trying to do but something, you know, but exactly the same thing?
Well, it's an amazing story, and it is told in Paul Trinka's new biography, Iggy Pop, Open Up and Bleed. Paul has joined us from the BBC studios in London. And Paul, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, John. Absolute pleasure.
Coming up in a moment, the Iraq Museum has recovered half of the art looted during the war, but it might not survive the suicide bombings. And later, a live performance by what some say is the prettiest voice in indie rock, that of Luke Temple. This is Soundcheck. He's gone.